Everyone loves a good mystery, and Chicago has enough of them to fill a library.
I'm Jeffrey Baer. Let's see if we can solve some of Chicago's most perplexing mysteries, like these.
A saucer-shaped gray disc hovering above gate C-17.
Where did this thing come from?
Whoa!
It's supposedly a portal to hell.
This?
Right here.
Caution, do not dig. Yeah. We don't know if there's anybody in there.
We don't know if there's anybody in there.
Why is that garage in the front?
Anybody here that wants to communicate?
Perhaps not.
Like, wow, it's an alligator.
It disappears and is never seen again.
Follow me down the rabbit hole as we explore Chicago mysteries.
Jeffrey Baer is an Emmy Award-winning writer, producer, and host for WTTW, known for feature-length programs about the architecture and history of Chicago, including The Most Beautiful Places in Chicago, Chicago by L, and the Chicago River Tour. Jeffrey also hosted the PBS series 10 That Changed America. He's also not afraid to use the phrase morbid gawkers, as he does in his new special, Chicago Mysteries, premiering April 16th on WTTW. Jeffrey Baer, welcome, as always.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you back. I think the last time we talked, you had said something about how you had this new project coming and you thought it would be out in March. So having it come out in April isn't too far behind. I hope that it was a fruitful experience for you.
Oh, this is maybe the most fun show I've ever done.
You definitely seem to be having a great time. I do want to commend you on, I've watched it twice now. The first one I watched with my youngest, who actually contributed a question. We'll get to that in a minute. But it was such a great blend of general interest. You had weird Chicago, you have goofy Chicago, and a couple of creepy stories. So I think when people see the word mysteries, they go, oh, it's going to be creepy. He's going to be walking around graveyards at night with, you know. But it wasn't that at all. I think you have a little something for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the idea of the show. You know, interestingly, one of the things that we had on our list, I had on the list from the beginning, was the unsolved mystery of the Tylenol murders, which your audience might know of, you know, quite a number of years ago, somebody unknown poisoned a bunch of Tylenol capsules, put them on store shelves, people bought them, and many people died. And about a third of the way through the project, in the editing, in the post-production, we cut it because the rest of the show has such a fun tone, even though there are some pretty creepy and grim things in the show. Most of them are from 100 years ago, so it doesn't have the same kind of immediacy. But we cut the Tylenol story because it was just, it didn't fit with the sort of fun tone of the show. We are doing a bit about it on the website because we got some fascinating interviews and great material, and we wanted to find a home for it. But in the actual show itself, the TV show, it just didn't fit because the show is so much fun.
So at my count, I think you have 15 individual mystery nuggets. Is that right?
So, yeah, because one of our interviewees takes us to three mysteries. So I guess yes. By that count, yeah, you would have 15 in the show.
My 14-year-old son Cooper wondered, how many mysteries did you start with and how did you narrow the list down?
That's a great question. Gosh. Dozens and dozens. You know, it's so for one limiting factor, of course, it's a 1-hour show. And you want the stories to have the ability to go into some degree of depth and storytelling. You know, if you're trying to cram 25 mysteries into a 1-hour show, everything gets, you know, a couple of minutes. And you don't get the satisfaction of really delving into the story in any detail. So we knew going in that we were going to have to make some difficult decisions. Now, I should say one of the great things about media these days is that we aren't just a TV show. We also have a website. And so we were able to include 3 or 4 more stories as web exclusives. And that was terrific that we could actually tell more stories that way in combination with the website and the TV program. Part of it, I think we already alluded to, had to do with tone. So the Tylenol murders, it was just too grim. It was too recent. And it was actually our editor who looked at, you know, we were all talking about, oh boy, we've got to cut a lot of time out of the show. And our editor said, you're not going to believe this, but I think we can cut the Tylenol story. And the producer, Sean Keenahan, and I was like, this light bulb went off. And we were like, yeah. And you know, because I don't know about Sean, but I was thinking that if there was one story that was just a given in the show, it was that one. So it's a question of tone is another way that we made decisions about what to include and what not to include. And I should give a lot of credit to our editor, Joe Winston, who is brutal. Joe, in a nice way. You know, Joe, I'd come into the editing room, Sean and Joe would be in there, and Joe would say, well, you know, I cut this 30 seconds out of the story because I don't think you need it. I'll put it back if you want, but I don't think you need it. And I'd look at it and Sean would look at it and we'd go, yeah, you're right. We can live without that. So there's a lot of artistry on the part of the producer, the writer, the editor, in deciding what goes in and what you can live without.
Was there anything you fought for to get put back in that they were like, we don't see eye to eye in this, GB, but if you really want to?
Yes, or there actually was.
Okay.
We have this story about Adolf Lutgert, the sausage king of Chicago, whose wife disappeared. And you can fill in the blanks there about, you know, it's a little Sweeney Todd-ish kind of story from the late 1800s. So it doesn't have the same immediacy that the story would have today in terms of being dark and grim. It's more sadly a kind of entertaining. When Adolf Lutgert was put on trial, when the jury went to deliberate, the newspapers, this was the era when the newspapers, there was no ethics like there is, you know, of course, there are a lot of ethics. But back then it was just yellow journalism and all these newspapers were just rapidly competing with each other. And this, so they wanted to get the scoop on what the jury was deliberating. So the newspaper, one of the newspapers took a team of reporters into the attic of the courthouse, lowered one of their reporters down the air shaft on a rope. And he hung outside of the, he sort of dangled outside of the jury room and listened through one of the heating vents and, you know, was speaking into a speaking tube and relaying the jury deliberations to the reporters on the roof, who were then relaying them to the newspaper. And they were literally printing the jury deliberations while the jury was still out. And I fought for that. The story was kind of one of the longer stories in the show. And my team were urging me, like, you know, that's a funny story, but we can really cut it because there's just so much. I was like, no, we cannot cut that. That is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. And then the art department, our wonderful graphic artist, Reed Marveen, created this wonderful animation of this guy going down the shaft and listening in to the jury deliberations. And he cuts around to the other side where we're in the jury room and you can see the heating vent on the wall. And I said, oh, Reed, you got to put like 2 eyes looking through the heating vent, you know, and then you got to make them go like blink, blink. And then we had the sound effects person make a little clink, clink sound when he blinked his eyes. It's hilarious.
I'm glad you fought for that. When I was watching it again with my son Cooper, he just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. Just the idea of it. Not to mention the fact that I think the courthouse, maybe 8 stories, maybe taller, where the idea of them being lowered on a rope without kind of a proper harness just seems bonkers. But, you know, I guess they would do anything to sell a story back then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, Robert Lorzel, who helped work with you on that, wrote an amazing book you've probably seen, Alchemy of Bones, all about that murder. Such a small murder, but boy, if there's anybody who's going to research the heck out of it, it's going to be Robert, certainly.
Yeah, I totally recommend that book, Alchemy of Bones. We used Robert as our interviewee in that segment and benefited greatly from his expertise on that story.
Right. Well, certainly going down to the area where the meat processing used to happen and where this guy allegedly turned his wife into meat products and disrupted the... I don't want to give all of it away, but...
No, and highly, I should say...
Highly recommended segment, yes.
Yeah, I should say the rumor was that he, kind of like Sweeney Todd, ground her up and turned her into meat. There is no evidence that he did that, but he was convicted of murdering her. And I should also say... That basement, that creepy basement that we were in, which used to be the sausage factory, is now a condo building on the north side of Chicago in kind of Lakeview, Lincoln Park area. And they had never allowed a camera crew in that basement before. So we got a bit of an exclusive there.
And is that just because it's not really made for people or because they've heard all the stories over the years?
You know, I couldn't tell you why, but that, again, tribute to Sean Keenahan, our producer, and Matthew Schimmel, our associate producer. I don't know how they quite, what magic words they used, but the condo association allowed us in. I mean, one of the conditions was that we couldn't give the address of the building or show it from the outside. So
sure.
People didn't really know where.
Yeah, you guys kept it kind of tight. So that's very cool. Speaking of people I know and I've had on the podcast, you had our friend Dilla on talking about the Garlo, which you being an architecture guy, how much do you love the Garlo? And do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, the Garlos are hilarious. And I'm really glad we were able to once again feature Sherman Dilla Thomas in our show. He's always a great addition to our roster. In the Chatham neighborhood, if you're driving down King Drive or maybe one or two other streets, you'll suddenly see what look like vacant lots. They're not vacant lots, but nicely kept expanses of lawn, basically. And the only building on the lot looks like the garage, way, way, way at the back of the lot, right up against the alley. But they're homes. So, and there's block after block of them. So why are there these, this is one of our Chicago mysteries. Why are there these strange little homes pushed way back to the back of the lot with these huge front lawns? And the reason is that the Garlo is a portmanteau. It's pushed together garage bungalow. And this was after World War I, there was a housing crisis. And it was a real estate solution where you couldn't really afford, you could maybe afford to buy a piece of a lot in Chicago, but you certainly couldn't afford to build a house on that lot. You might be able to afford to build a garage on that lot. So this developer figured out this plan out where you could build a home, but it was really just the size of a garage. So it was a very tiny home. And then the idea was you'd live there for a little while. And then if you got more money after a while, you could then build a proper house on the lot and convert this little home into your garage. And they even built them with a metal beam embedded in the wall along the alley, so that once you were able to move into your newly built two flat or home, you could literally tear out that back wall and make it into a garage door. And then you could use it as a garage. So they were the Garlos.
And the Great Depression happened. A lot of people decided not to convert it, much like when the city raised up, there were a lot of people who just decided not to have their house raised up, which I think you've covered in stuff in the past. But yeah, the Garlo is kind of an interesting thing because I think it is very neighborhood specific, but those great front lawns that seem to extend forever all the way to the alley in the back are kind of cool.
And then
to
of
see.
Course, one or two of them, it's really funny. They did build on their lot, but they put a garage on the lot. Instead of a house.
Right, a garage behind the Garlo. So they have two very
in front
similar,
of the Garlo.
Right. But two similarly sized structures next to each other. And
so they just kept living in the Garlo and put the garage on the front of the lot.
I had Jessica Linarek on a while back to talk about her scavenger book, which if you haven't seen it, it's very cool. It gives people an idea with history backing of all these different neighborhoods you can go in and stuff you can see. So you actually had her out to the Lamont Palis area to talk about nuclear reactor stuff. I won't give too much away. You had her out to 103rd and Avenue G for one of the oldest monuments in Chicago, and also out to Niles. So I would love to talk about the Leaning Tower of Niles. And for those listeners who are not familiar with this structure, please share.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. There is actually a 1/2 size, very convincing replica of the Leaning Tower of Pisa in Niles, Illinois, which is a near Chicago suburb. It's actually right on the border of Chicago, a little bit to the sort of, I don't know if you call it northwest, but it's kind of in between the North Shore and the northwest suburbs. So this was, you know, and if you know Niles today, it's kind of got a lot of post-World War II housing. It's a very diverse community actually today. There was a bit of industry in Niles at one time, but long before that, in the 1930s, it was just the countryside. And so this industrialist named Ilg, I-L-G, who had a company that made industrial ventilation products in Chicago, wanted to create a park for his workers. So they could have a place to go and picnic and relax, and it would be a little outing in the countryside. And there was a pool. And so he built this in Niles. And so the pool, apparently, I don't know quite how this works, but the pool needed a water tower associated with it. And Ilg was a big fan of Galileo. And so he built the water tower as a replica of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And he, remarkably, this was something I don't know if I even knew this until we got to the site. I might have known this ahead of time. I can't quite remember. But up at the top of the tower, you can spiral, you walk up the tower, and you get kind of dizzy. And it's a little weird because it's on an angle. So as you're kind of walking up, you're going uphill and downhill. And it's a little disorienting. But you get to the top, and there are these church bells that Ilg acquired. These are from 17th century Italian churches, and they've been restored. They're intact. A couple of them no longer work, but they are remarkable. He somehow got these church bells. I think churches get torn down or whatever, and he somehow sourced these and put them in his tower. And Niles has got them all hooked up so that they ring periodically, maybe every hour. I'm not quite sure, but they ring. And we actually went up there, Jessica and I. The tower's not open to the public, but right now. But they hope to open it up at some point. But they did allow Jessica and I and our camera crew to scale the tower. And then we reached underneath the bells, and we were ringing these 17th century Italian church bells, which I understand some neighbors later wondered what was going on. And what a thrill! Yeah. So it's kind of this just really crazy roadside attraction. The park is long gone. Ilg is long gone, and it became property of the YMCA. It was kind of a popular landmark in Niles for a long time because it was part of the YMCA. I don't think that's even the case anymore. I think the municipality of Niles owns it now, and they have plans to make more out of the plaza around it.
I remember as a kid driving from the southwest suburbs to visit friends of my parents when I was a kid and seeing this tower and thinking, gosh, I thought that was somewhere in Europe. Like I had no comprehension and I didn't know how to ask the question because I was little, but I always thought that was so very cool. And it also let me know that we were fairly close to where we were going because that trip seemed to take forever. So any issues? So watching you guys, again, scale the paths to get all the way to the top, I thought, gosh, if somebody wasn't comfortable with height or had vertigo, that would be a not so pleasant experience. But no issues, huh?
No, not really. I don't have a whole lot of issues with height, but I think you're right. I mean, the it's the railings are quite solid and high enough, but the fact that it's tilted is very weird. Yeah. As you climb the tower, it's very strange.
Well, kudos to your camera crew for being able to drag all their gear up there and film you guys as well as they did, because it looks great. You had Mark Chrysler from the Constant Podcast, and really, if you're going to have a podcast person on that isn't me, Mark is a great guy because he's so passionate about one of my favorite things in the world, the Fool Killer. And I'll jump ahead. One of the things that I thought was great about this is that you start talking with somebody who is passionate about this Fool Killer, and I'm going to make you talk about it in a second. And then you actually segued to Marianne Mather and Corey Rumor, who do this amazing thing every week. It's a newsletter called the Vintage Chicago Tribune Newsletter, where they talk about great things from the past. And I thought, what a great blending of all these resources to talk about this very interesting thing called the Fool Killer. So please share with the audience about the Fool Killer.
Well, big credit to my producer, Sean Keenahan. This is one that Sean fought for, not the story itself, finding a way to include those wonderful super sleuths, Marianne Mather and Corey Rumor from the Chicago Tribune. I initially couldn't quite see the connection there, but it works beautifully in the show. Yeah. So you're talking about this vessel that was discovered on the bottom of the Chicago River, sunken in 1915. And it seemed like it was a little miniature submarine, big enough to hold maybe four people. A diver who was a bit of a publicity hound, kind of a big self-promoter named William Frenchy Deneau, claimed that he stubbed his toe on it while he was down underwater on the bottom of the Chicago River laying some cable in 1915, and actually in the middle of the winter. And so they hoisted it up to the surface. And I don't know, maybe this is still true today, you know, salvage rights or something, but apparently because he found it, the authorities decided he owned it. So he claimed he found human remains and a dog skull inside, and he wanted to make a little money off of his discovery. So he put it in a skee ball arcade on State Street in Chicago and charged people a dime a piece to go inside if you dare. And there was really splashy, you know, posters and things publicizing it. But Sean had the idea, well, you know, since this guy was such a publicity hound, he must have been all over the newspapers. So we went to this amazing archive at the Chicago Tribune that is stewarded by Marianne and Corey. It's their morgue. It's called the morgue. It's where they have all the old clippings, all the old newspapers, and just glass plate negatives and old photographs. It's a remarkable collection, and you know, they were able to unearth some glass plate negatives of William Frenchy Deneau, and then I won't go into all the details. It's a very complicated story that I'm very proud that we sort of simplified and made understandable for a five or six minute story, because it was really, really difficult to kind of truly tell the story, but also get all the elements in, because there's another character who shows up, a completely different character. It was quite an achievement to simplify that story, but it was great to be able to get all the resources from the Tribune morgue. And I should also say that, you know, the plan is that the Tribune is going to, the Tribune has consolidated everything into their printing plant up on the North Branch of the Chicago River, up by Goose Island. But that because of the casino deal, if it goes through, which, you know, there's always, who knows, but the Tribune is supposed to move out of that printing plant very soon and tear it down. And the question is, what's going to happen to the morgue? What's going to happen to this priceless collection of the entire history of the Chicago Tribune? Particularly because the owners now are venture capitalists who have no investment in Chicago history, or it seems like journalism, frankly, despite the valiant efforts of the few people who are left on the Tribune staff. Forgive my editorializing. One imagines the collection will be preserved, but how and where, as far as I know at this point, is still undetermined.
I will say the great thing about the Fool Killer, and this actually goes back to the collection, is that the Fool Killer story is actually two separate stories that are connected. And the other story I found equally fascinating, and yes, I've done a lot of reading about it as well. But the interesting thing is, when the Tribune was talking about the Fool Killer, one of the final comments in one of the articles that I read was, it will likely be stored at the Chicago Historical Museum or something like that. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because the whereabouts, of course, well, I don't want to give it away. It didn't end up at the History Museum. So something to look forward to. All right. I know we are running out of time. I have a few more things. So you've already mentioned that additional stories will be available on WTTW.com/Chicago Mysteries. What other stories are going to be available there?
Oh, it's a great collection of stories. So one of them is, what is the Chicago handshake? Do you know what the Chicago handshake is?
Of course I do. So now I have to ask you, because I think I saw that you tried Malort, which is part of the Chicago handshake. Was this really your first time trying Malort in all these years? You've never tried Malort?
No.
All right.
So the Chicago handshake, for those who don't know, is a shot of Malort, which is this vicious drink.
It's a bitter botanical liqueur, yes.
which was promoted as a health tonic during Prohibition, and it's from Scandinavia, and followed by a chaser of a tall boy of Old Style, which is from Milwaukee. So, you know, the question is, how did these two beverages, neither of which is from Chicago, come to be paired and called a Chicago handshake? And I'm not sure we satisfactorily answer that, but the person who introduces me to the Chicago handshake is Monica Eng, who's the wonderful Axios reporter and food expert. And she told me there's a thing called Malort face, where when you have your first drink of Malort, the person who serves it to you has their cell phone ready, and they snap a picture of you as you drink the Malort. And then there's a whole, like, you know, social media thing of Malort face. And I gave her a good one, and I was not acting. but it actually makes Old Style taste pretty good.
Oh, well, listen, I like Old Style, and I'm sure Monica told you, or maybe it came up along the way, that the Malort recipe has changed over the years, and I think it's so much better than it was 10 or 15 years ago when it was really bitter and it felt like drinking antifreeze. So, yes, you and Monica addressed the Chicago hot dog wonderfully and why you don't put ketchup on it. I noticed you were at Sox Park. So what do you like on your hot dog?
I go for the Chicago hot dog. Totally.
You go the full thing. I'll
drag it through the garden. The whole thing.
Nice. With
and
peppers.
Course, pardon me?
With peppers?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And no ketchup, obviously.
Well, sure. Are you more inclined?
I won't give a spoiler here, but I will say that I think we really gave a very satisfactory, and some of the mysteries in the show are unsolved, and I think that's fine. But I think we gave a really satisfactory answer about why there is no ketchup on a Chicago hot dog. The thing you'll always hear people say is, oh, well, it's because, you know, that's got a lot of sugar and it spoils the taste of the hot dog. That would be true anywhere. That would be true in Cleveland or New York or L.A. So why is the no ketchup a Chicago thing specifically? And I think we actually come up with a pretty good answer to that.
Oh,
thanks.
I think you guys crushed it. And I thought there's nothing I would add to that other than the fact that I don't care what people put on their hot dog, but, you know, that's a thing. So are you more inclined to go to a White Sox game or a Cubs game?
I'm a lifelong Cubs fan.
I figured you were, which is why when I saw you at Sox Park talking about hot dogs, I thought, oh, interesting.
The Sox, I mean, they let me throw out the first pitch in one of our previous shows. I went around the infield, grooming the infield with the sod father. They welcomed us to do this hot dog thing. So they were just, but I will say in my next upcoming show, which is called Chicago Works, we have been granted permission to film inside the scoreboard and show the story of how the guys inside the scoreboard, you know, work.
Sure.
And so I'm thrilled. I'm really excited. And thank you, Chicago Cubs, for letting us do that.
When can people expect your upcoming Chicago Works? Is that in the fall?
Yeah, it'll be on in December. And it's all about what you don't see. You know, the guys who operate, the men and women who raise and lower the bridges in Chicago. We went behind the scenes of the Lyric Opera, and they put to the wig shop, and they made a couple wigs and put them on me. You know, we went behind the scenes at United Center and showed them changing over from a basketball court to a hockey rink. And I got to shoot a basket where the Bulls shoot baskets, and I got to skate around on the ice where the Bulls skate. So that was pretty thrilling. So that's Chicago Works coming in December.
And was your shot through the hoop, or did they cut away and let somebody else finish the shot for you?
I made a couple.
Did you?
I had not really shot any baskets since junior high school, so I wasn't very good at it. But I made a few of them.
Knowing that you were there, you didn't like find a, you know, alley court or just somewhere to throw a couple shots so nobody could make fun of you?
Not in the lead. And there's a basketball court in the little park on my block here, but I did not do any practicing ahead of time, which I should have, maybe because of the weather. When I was invited to throw out the first pitch at Sox Park, I practiced for a long time because I'm a big baseball fan and I didn't want to make a fool out of myself.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than the guy who just buries it into the dirt 10 feet in front of the batter.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, not a good look.
No, I mean, I think I went the other direction. I almost threw it over his head.
Oh, well, that's impressive as well. Chicago Mysteries premieres April 16th at 7 p.m. Central Time, streaming at WTTW.com/Chicago Mysteries. Jeffrey Bear, it is always a thrill to see you, and I'm excited for everybody else to see the upcoming programs.
I'm really excited for it too. And thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. We'll see you soon.
All right.
Special thanks to the one and only Jeffrey Bear for coming on today's show to talk about Chicago Mysteries. If you have a topic you think might be worth covering in an upcoming episode of the Chicago History Podcast, send me an email at chicagohistorypod@gmail.com. If I cover it in a future episode, I'll be sure to give you credit for suggesting it. For more pictures and info related to the topics covered today, follow Chicago History Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a 5-star rating or even better, a written review, especially if you listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, as it will help the podcast grow and reach new fans. Your review may be featured on a future episode or on social media. The Chicago History Podcast logo and the art used on the social media pages was created by John K. Schneider, Rockstar Johnny. He can be found via email at angeleyesartjks@gmail.com. We'll be back soon with another chapter in Chicago's history. Until then, check out Chicago Mysteries on WTTW. After that, get out and explore when possible. Learn more about whatever city you live in. Stay safe.